Hello there, and welcome to another episode of Cooper Talks. And in this one, I'm going to be having a look at a Cold War topic, following on from the Prague Spring episode, if you're going back and working through these in topical order, rather than the order I randomly produce them. And we're going to be looking at this idea called détente, which kind of means de-thawing or easing of tensions and relations. And it's a bit of a vague term, and you can't really say it's one particular event, but it more talks about a shift in attitudes that happened across the 1960s and 1970s in the Cold War. And it's had a lot of interpretation, so it is a bit of a tricky idea, and I'm going to go through some of the sort of key highlights of détente. But I'm going to start by thinking about why détente happened and what it meant and why it was so important. So, if we imagine the first period of the Cold War being, well, we'll go as far as the Cuban Missile Crisis, okay? So, we go from the original conference, which I'm sure everyone remembers is Tehran, and the growing tension between the Soviet Union and the USA. Now, when World War II ends, because of the devastation across Europe and in Japan, China itself is back into civil war. Really, there are only two superpowers in the world. One of them, very clear superpower, was America, that not only had the nuclear bomb, but also had huge amounts of wealth and resources. And arranged opposite them was the Soviet Union, which was emerging as a superpower. It didn't quite have the financial resources of America, and initially it didn't have the atomic bomb, but it did have a huge army and a lot of power and reputation across the world. And really, those were the only two contenders. And so this first part of the Cold War is really the direct confrontation and competition between these two superpowers. And in essence, the world was divided into two groups. I really could say three, the non-aligned as a separate group. But realistically, certainly from a European perspective, the world was aligned into the capitalist bloc, which was basically at this time led by America, and the communist bloc, which was led by and dominated by the Soviet Union. And so everyone within these two blocs was tightly bound to the actions of the big state, the big leader. So what would become Western Europe with the formation of NATO, etc., and the close bond of alliances would come under the American sphere of influence. And because America was the only really powerful and wealthy country on the Western side in the 1940s, 50s and early 60s, it therefore dictated everything. On the Soviet side, you get the communist countries being established in Eastern Europe. You get the development of what's the Warsaw Pact and the various things that link them together. And again, from what you will have learned about the Cold War so far, it was all dominated and controlled very much by the Soviet Union. And these two camps, basically American camp and Soviet camp, they are competing with each other. And really, the whole first part of the Cold War is about the USSR trying to gain superpower parity or equality with America. So you get the arms race developing. America does not want the USSR to achieve parity. And so there's constant conflict and tension between them as they are competing with each other for domination in the world. And the Soviet Union's trying to expand and increase its dominance and its status to prove it's a superpower. And America, because of the Truman Doctrine, is trying to stop this. Okay, and that's really why we get all these sorts of events and crises going across in the first part of the Cold War. And most of it is playing out in Europe because, thanks to the division of Germany and Berlin, that's where the two sides basically are next to each other. So there's a lot of focus on Europe and the European division. There has been less focus on the rest of the world, although that will start to come into play. However, it could start earlier, and there's no defined point of when exactly détente starts, but we'll go from after the Cuban Missile Crisis. we start to see a shift. And this is what détente is about. It's about a shift in mindset. Okay? So, up to the Cuban Missile Crisis, it has really been these two superpowers dominating their spheres and clashing with each other. After the Cuban Missile Crisis, they begin a process of trying to accommodate each other. Now, part of this is because by the mid-1960s, by around 1965, I think, the Soviet Union had managed to achieve parity in terms of nuclear weaponry, in terms of the number of nuclear weapons and so on, with the USA. So now they had equality, and the USA had to decide, well, do we keep pushing? Do we try to escalate? Look how close we got to nuclear war in the Cold War, in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Or do we try and find a way of live and let live, of accommodating each other in some ways? And that's really what détente was about. Going from a shift of outright hostility and opposition to a sense of accommodation where they could learn to live with each other, and the world was divided up as it was, and, you know, they would work. They wouldn't be friends or allies, but they'd find a way of respecting each other and leaving each other to its own spheres. Now, the Cuban Missile Crisis may have been a trigger for that, realising how close they came to nuclear war, and that actually there was a degree of parity now and there was no sense trying to fight that. Both sides would end up being destroyed. But it also comes from the changing circumstances we get in the 1960s. So, what's changed? By the 1960s, both in the USSR and in the USA, their economies are starting to slow down. And certainly in the USA by the 1970s, this is going to see a bit of a financial crisis, okay? Kind of a recession where they realise they can't keep spending as they have been doing. Now, a lot of that has to do with the Vietnam War, which is a separate podcast, and the spending inflation and things that are done there that stops them developing other ideas. The other issue is that in both countries, they lose their dominant position over their respective power blocks. So let's start with America. Obviously, thanks to martial aid, thanks to its domination of NATO and all these things, the USA had, in the 1940s, 1950s, clearly been the central and important leading state within the capitalist bloc. And all the other countries were kind of just grateful to have American resources and American infrastructure and things like that. By the time we get to the 1960s, though, in Europe at least, most of the countries have kind of rebuilt after World War II. And you get the developing economic miracle in Germany. France is coming back. Britain is starting to grow. And by the 1960s, they're kind of less dependent on America. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to go into hostility with America, but they're going to start exerting their own independence a bit more and basically going to try and stop being a puppet of the USA and being more their own country. And this could be symbolised by, in 1966, as a reaction to the Cuban Missile Crisis, Charles de Gaulle, the president of France, withdrew France from the military side of NATO because they said, no, they didn't like the way America was acting in the Cuban Missile Crisis without considering Europe. And you also got Germany becoming a bit more independent as well, and America, and even making their own terms for better relationships with the Soviet Union. Because, of course, Germany, France, Europe, there, if a war happened, it's likely that's where the fighting would be. And so rather than relying on America now, particularly because they hadn't been consulted during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the growing European economic community in these countries are going to become more independent and do their own thing. You also had in the East, in Japan, the Japanese economy starting to really get going and to pick up. And actually, to rival the domination of America as the capitalist main economic force. Now, America's still way, way ahead of any other country, but it's no longer the undisputed champion. And there are cracks there. And so in order to manage its domination, its sort of oversight of the capitalist world, they have to, America has to kind of readjust and refocus its mindset. It has other problems it now needs to focus on and deal with. And what it could do without is standing up unilaterally to the Soviet Union, having to be combative all the time. So part of the reason, from the American point of view, there's financial. It needs to try and cut costs and save money in the arms race. It wants to kind of reduce nuclear weaponry. And it also needs to accept the growing independence of other capitalist countries. And that means it has to be less aggressive in the face of the USSR. So that's one, that's a few reasons why the USA wanted to seek an accommodation and wanted to pursue detente in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis and throughout the 60s and 70s. From the Soviet point of view, what happens during the 60s that really gets it going, apart from Nikita Khrushchev being replaced by Leonid Brezhnev, which changes the dynamic slightly, they've got the big problem of what's going on in China. So initially, China had become a communist state back in the late 40s, 50s, and had obviously been very dependent on the USA, on the USSR. However, by the 1960s, Chairman Mao in China is starting to assert his authority on global communism and actually starts becoming antagonistic towards the USA. Now, one of the big things is, I think it's 1965, China, thanks to Russian support and help, gets the nuclear bomb, it gets nuclear technology. And this will enable it to be more independent. It doesn't need to worry about an American attack anymore because it's and Soviet, the Soviet Union protecting it because it's got its own nuclear bomb. Then you get the whole issue with Chairman Mao being super critical of Leonid Brezhnev following the Prague Spring and saying, no, you shouldn't have invaded, you're a terrible leader. And actually, the war of words between the two, turning into actual armed conflict in the Sino-Soviet split, when they actually go different ways and they start becoming antagonistic and even go to war with each other. Now, having China, which shares a very long border with the USSR, in open hostility and rivaling it within the communist camp, means the USSR could do without fighting the USA as well. It can't afford a war on two fronts. You also have the reaction to the Prague Spring with things like Romania becoming more distant and Albania leaving the Warsaw Pact. And basically, much like the USA, the USSR has lost its dominant position on the capitalist, on the communist side. And so they're going to have to chill their boots a bit. They're going to have to ease off and try and sort out their position within communism and sort out what's going there. And that's going to lead to them trying to seek an accommodation and end the outright hostility with America. And so those are kind of the groundworks and the reasons why detente would happen. And in some ways, America had the big advantage here, because with China and the Soviet Union becoming hostile, America will be able to play them off against each other. And Richard Nixon will do that very, very effectively, which I shall come back to later. So that's kind of why detente happens. Now, don't worry, that's much higher level than GCSE if you're a GCSE student. But it does help explain its importance, and it's really what it was, this mental shift in global politics between hostility to accommodation between the main powers. Now, let's have a little look at some of the steps and processes that were involved in detente. Really, the first step we might go back to is the Cuban, following the Cuban Missile Crisis, the establishment of a hotline. And this was a direct phone line to connect the Kremlin to Washington, D.C. And this was because of the slow pace of getting the letters and telegrams from the Soviet Union to Washington, D.C. And they wanted to improve the communication to avoid a situation like that happening again. So it was a small step, but it was a sign of improved communication. So that's pretty important. Now, although that was a significant first step, it was kind of quite small. So the main part of SALT is actually going to come a bit later. So, SALT, that's the wrong thing, detente. What you do see in the 1960s, though, is both being distracted. As I said, Soviet Union is going to be distracted by the Sino-Soviet War. America is going to be distracted and have problems in Vietnam. So they're kind of ignoring each other because they've got other problems to deal with. So they don't really have much cause for outright hostility. And it does give Leonid Brezhnev, he of the very large eyebrows, time to bed in as leader. And again, he sees the reality of the situation. He wants America to leave them alone. He wants the Soviet Union to be dominant and a major superpower. But he's going to be less confrontational than Khrushchev was. And he's more willing at this stage to see an accommodation as long as he can dominate the communist world. So it's a different personality there. And they're going to start working together and compromising. Now, although both are distracted and both are seeking accommodations and avoiding direct hostility, as we'd seen with, say, the Berlin Wall being built and the Cuba Missile Crisis, they're going to now start turning their attention away from Europe and looking at what's happening in the rest of the world, and they're going to see the widening of the Cold War. Now, the reason for this is a lot of countries in the world in the late 50s and into the 1960s were seeking independence. A lot of these were former colonies of European powers that were either fighting for independence or had recently received independence and were trying to get support and aid, or there were warring factions between them. Now, a good example of that is the conflict that came to the Middle East. And this was largely to do with the Arab-Israeli conflict. Now, that's a whole set of podcasts I'll do separately at some point in the future. But essentially, America had heavily invested and backed Israel. A number of the Arab states saw Israel as the biggest threat to their security. And they went with the old maxim, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So Arab states looking and saying, we're worried about Israel. America supports Israel. So who might help us against Israel? Ah, someone else who really dislikes the USA. And so what you end up with is a 6-day war where the Arab states basically end up attacking Israel but being defeated in 6 days because Israel is supported by American military. And they will start to turn more towards the Soviet Union in the hope of getting aid and support. Now, the irony of this is communism, and officially in the Soviet Union, it was atheist and it had no track with religion. And a lot of the Arab states were quite fond of their religion. And so they weren't natural allies of communism, and particularly because a number of the Arab states were like absolute monarchies, kind of the complete opposite of the principles of communism. However, the USSR saw it as a means of getting allies who could take on an American ally. And this leads to the development of something called the proxy war, where both sides are finding accommodation and working with each other officially, but they're sort of funding and helping smaller conflicts between pro-capitalist and pro-communist. This is something we see in the Vietnam War, where you have Ho Chi Minh in the north. He's not really a communist, but the Americans are propping up the south, which isn't even really a democracy, but it's just not communist. So the Americans are supporting the south, so Ho Chi Minh aligns with communist states in order to get support against the Americans. And you'll see this repeated across Africa, as both sides try and seek domination over the third, or developing world, as we call it today. At the time they called it the third world, but developing world. So parts of Asia, Latin America, and sub-Saharan Africa. And this, you'll end up seeing sort of America supplying weapons and resources to, well, sometimes they're genuine democracies, but more often than not, they're kind of corrupt or right-wing fascist regimes or groups who just claim to be anti-communist. And the Soviet Union will do the same for people that aren't really communist but will call themselves anti-capitalist. And you get this across sub-Saharan Africa. You get wars in places like Namibia and, well, between Namibia and Angola, and sides will play each side off against themselves. So we get this widening of the global Cold War at the same time as detente is easing relationships and improving it between the two main protagonists. But this is obviously costing a lot of money, particularly for America with Vietnam, as the Vietnam War goes horrendously wrong and is causing all sorts of problems at home, financially, politically, and militarily. So, detente really gets going under Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon, as I mentioned earlier, he plays off both sides against each other. So the Chinese invite Richard Nixon to Beijing and he accepts. And as soon as he's accepted Beijing, Moscow almost instantly sends that message. Oh, no, please come and visit us here in Moscow, because they didn't want to be outdone by China. So that rivalry is playing to America's advantage. And so the president of the United States going to Moscow, and they make it clear that actually Vietnam and the hostility, that's not an issue to the process of detente. We can carry on being friends. The Soviet Union says it starts to put pressure on North Vietnam. I mean, how much pressure it was really putting on, but publicly at least it was trying to persuade North Vietnam maybe to go easy on America, maybe to sign a truce or something like that. Took a while before that did happen, but anyway, they start publicly working for it. And also the Soviet Union wanted to sort of make an accommodation with American technology. Now, what they agreed to here is they agreed to a European Security Conference. And that comes out of a meeting in Helsinki where they came through what's called the Helsinki Agreements. And these were a set of agreements that came out in 1975, following a meeting in Helsinki in 1974, where they agree to three baskets. They call them baskets, don't know why, but they do. There's security, which means they will recognise the division of East-West Germany and the current borders in Europe, so ease tensions there. And the Soviet Union recognises officially West Germany, so that's going to ease tensions. They also call for closer economic, scientific and cultural links to get closer political agreement. Now, what the Soviet Union's after here is really American technology and investment. The Americans aren't gaining a lot from this cooperation, except they use it as a means of trying to persuade the Soviet Union to ensure human rights and basic freedoms, such as speech, religion, and freedom from unfair arrest, which the Soviet Union will sign up to, but it's not exactly enforced. Okay, so that comes a bit after this. The first really major treaty that comes out of Nixon's travelling to Moscow was what's called the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks. This is called SALT I, okay? The first Strategic Arms Limitation Talks. And these were in 1972. And this was kind of the first formal moment for detente. It was a treaty signed between the two. And it was an attempt to try and limit the amount of nuclear weapons in the world, which would reduce costs for both sides and without losing face, because neither side wanted to admit that it couldn't afford all the nuclear weapons it had. So it allowed the anti-ballistic missile treaty systems were only allowed at two sites. Now, this is because of the theory, the mad theory, that they wouldn't go to war because both sides could wipe each other out. What both sides had developed were types of missiles that could knock out nuclear weapons that were flying over the sky. These are the anti-ballistic missiles. So obviously they kind of create a protective ring that undermines MAD. So they said, okay, we agree we'll only have them at two sites with no more than 100 missiles, okay? So weirdly, it was a way of trying to remove the protection from intercontinental ballistic missiles, which could wipe out the whole country. So it seems a weird one, but by removing these or restricting them to just two, both sides, you know, could say, ah, see, we can still destroy each other. So it shows a degree of trust. Also, these were incredibly expensive. There was also an interim agreement on offensive arms, which meant there was a 5-year freeze on the total number of intercontinental ballistic missiles, huge nuclear bombs, and submarine launch ballistic missiles. So again, they're restricting the use of these really powerful intercontinental missiles. However, while it reduced nuclear missiles, it didn't reduce the number of bombers, particularly nuclear bombers designed to carry nuclear weapons. And it didn't, at this time, limit the amount of bombs each side could have. So you could still have the bombs, it was just you couldn't send them up in a big missile. There were no restrictions on what were called multiple independently targetable re-entry vehicles, or MIRVs, which I'm still not sure how they work. Basically, they seem to have like one missile, but like breaks up into 25 different parts, and each one's a hugely powerful nuclear bomb. So, you know, one missile, huge amount of death. And each side was allowed to use satellites to check the other is not breaking the limitations they've agreed on arms, particularly the anti-ballistic missiles. So they basically agreed to spy on each other using satellite technology. To be fair, neither of them could have stopped the other from using satellites. So it's kind of an agreement of reality. What's significant about this is it's the first time there is an actual agreement between the two sides to stop or to reduce or restrict the use of nuclear weapons. And that's a big step forward. Now, it then gets tested in 1973. We have the Yom Kippur War, which again, could have gone badly here. It's a war between Israel and Middle Eastern states. So it's another Arab-Israeli war. It's particularly between Syria and Egypt. And basically, it's a proxy war. Soviet Union supplying Syria and Egypt, and America supplying Israel. And at this time, Brezhnev goes, I know, I've got a cunning idea. Why don't we help the Egyptians a bit more and actually work together, the USA and Soviet Union working together to force the Egyptians and Israelis to kind of... hang on, what am I talking about here? Yeah, sorry, I was talking rubbish there. Well, basically, Brezhnev says, hey, why don't we go in together, USA and Soviet Union? We'll go in and we'll stop the war from happening, by which he means we're going to rescue the Egyptian army from the Israelis. And Brezhnev thought this is a great move because if America refuses, they look like, well, they don't care about the Arab states. And we, the Soviet Union, will say, well, we're going in anyway. And we'll take unilateral action. So it was kind of a provocation there, because Nixon refuses. He says, no way, Israel's our ally. We're not going to go and save the Egyptian army. And you better not go in there unilaterally, because that basically be like a major war. And so it was a risk here that detente could be underdone very early on. In the end, what's proposed by the Americans is to use the UN and use a UN peacekeeping force with non-nuclear countries, so not Britain, France, America, Soviet Union or China, that would go in to basically sort the situation out and calm things down, which is what happened. So again, they were discussing the strategy here, and although they were antagonistic, they came out with a solution that both could live with. So it is another evidence of the accommodation. Nixon will then visit Moscow in 1974, and again would have the discussions that would lead to the Helsinki agreements. Again, at the visit to Moscow, they agree to try and remove the danger of war, particularly nuclear weapons. So a lot of talk, not necessarily a lot of action, to try and end the arms race, maybe even, well, agree that they like the idea of complete disarmament, that a world without nuclear weapons. But of course, who's going to go first there? They would try and eliminate sources of international tension, which is what they said. It's a nice idea, but they didn't really do much about that. Ease tensions of a nuclear war across the world and basically develop commercial, economic, scientific and cultural research, which they could do together. And the biggest symbol of this cooperation was the development of the International Space Station. Now, this will come after a spacecraft meetup, where a Soviet spacecraft will meet up and connect with a US spacecraft, and they'll sort of go through and they'll shake hands, and it will show that everyone's happy and working with each other. And it was a great symbol of unity and global peace, and it would lead to the construction of what is still up there, the International Space Station. So that was another pretty big moment for detente. So up to the mid-1970s, everything looks hunky-dory and like it's all going wonderfully well. However, following Helsinki in 1977, you got a new US president, a guy called Jimmy Carter. And he, very admirably, he was very bothered about human rights. And he started pointing out that although the Soviet Union had agreed to the human rights element of the Helsinki Agreement, there was clear evidence they weren't doing this. Plus, in terms of security, there was growing evidence that they were sending vast amounts of weaponry and resources to war zones in Ethiopia and Ethiopia and Angola, which is the Angola-Namibia war, and ended up sending loads by the 1980s to about 21 different countries. So they start really putting international pressure. They start publicizing this, which becomes an embarrassment for Brezhnev. And so they keep doing this. Brezhnev saying, no, we're not going to do that. So it shows that although the agreements and toleration are there, the tensions are still present and there's still a lot of antagonism to each other. And because Brezhnev isn't stopping any of this, Jimmy Carter in the late 1970s starts to order the USA to start building up its defense spending and its research. So for all the great hoo-ha in 1974 about the Helsinki Agreement and the previous agreement with the SALT I agreement, yeah, we're going to restrict arms, actually hasn't taken long, both sides saying, we don't trust you, so we're just going to start spending a lot more money. Now, also in 1974, they begun talks on another strategic arms limitation treaty. Well, a strategic arms limitation treaty, which was called SALT II, because it was the second one. Now, this starts in 1974, but the tensions between the two, all the proxy wars and everything, means it's not actually signed between the leaders until June 1979. So it takes 5 years. So again, not that much accommodation here. Now, what was meant to happen with SALT II is that each side would agree to a limit of 2,400 nuclear delivery vehicles. Now that could be land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, submarine launched ballistic missiles, or those flown by plane using heavy bombers. So each side would have an equal number of nuclear bombs. 2,400 still more than enough to destroy most of the world. They agreed to a limit of MIRV systems to 1,320 on each side. They agreed to a ban on construction of new land-based ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile launchers, limits on the deployment of new types of strategic offensive arms. And that's an interesting one, deployment. What do you mean by deployment? Ready to go or in existence? And that this would last, I mean, they started writing it in 1974, but it was meant to last till 1985. However, although the treaty was signed, America has a bit of a rule. And that rule, or that constitutional requirement, is that any treaty has to be approved by the Senate, by Congress. And so although it was signed by Jimmy Carter, it then had to go back to the US, to the USA, where it was going to take time to be officially voted on and decided why it was going to be ratified. For those who've listened to the Treaty of Versailles one, that's the reason the Treaty of Versailles got rejected. They had to wait for Senate confirmation. Now, something I'll look at separately, in the interim, in 1979, SALT II is sent off. It's sent off to the Senate. But at that point, towards the end of 1979, the Soviet Union will invade Afghanistan. And that will basically cause the official end of this whole period of detente, because it's seen as an outright and aggressive action, and the SALT II treaty will be rejected by the Senate and will never actually happen. And yeah, hostilities will then start increasing again throughout the 1980s. So there you go, that's detente for you. Sort of a vague concept where in the mid-1960s till the end of the 1970s, it's a shift in attitudes and accommodation. In terms of substantial achievements, apart from maybe the space station and a bit more cooperation, not a lot of practical value actually emerges. It is important for international relations between the two because it's an accommodation that allows them to focus on other things and accommodate each other. However, although it's a sort of easing in the Cold War, it doesn't come close to ending the Cold War, and both sides are still in opposition to each other, even if it's not as outright hostile. And that's kind of the middle period of the Cold War before they get quite hostile again. But that's for another story. So I know détente is quite a confusing and complex set of ideas. And I might come back and try and do a simplified version at some point. But hopefully this has given you a flavour of the key ideas and kind of at least what the principle of détente was and what was involved with it. If nothing else, it was an accommodation. It saw some attempts to limit arms with SALT I, with the Helsinki agreements and improve security around the world, and even SALT II. But ultimately, there were still proxy wars going on, and both sides were still antagonistic to each other throughout this period, just less focused on direct confrontation between the two. Right, I hope that little summary has given you a bit of an idea about détente, and I shall be back probably to tell you a bit about Afghanistan in the near future. Take care, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye.